is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll explore the issues surrounding adrenal insufficiency and what can be done about it. Plus, in our What's Your Emergency segment, how seasonal changes can precipitate real breathing problems. But first, the dental issues that cancer patients can face. Cancer and its treatments can wreak havoc on our entire bodies. But what can happen to our teeth, and what should we be doing about it? Here with the answers to these questions is Dr. Patrick Smith, an assistant professor of surgery and the residency program director of the Dental Service and Clinic at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Smith. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So there are really special concerns for our teeth during due to cancer, the disease, and its treatments, I guess.
That is correct. Teeth are a particular, almost you want to think of them as an organ of the body that needs its own particular attention. And so it requires special care when we learn of a cancer diagnosis.
Let's start with something that really starts in the home of the mouth, which is oral cancer, because that's one particular kind of cancer.
Correct.
Tell us about what exactly is it?
Oral cancer? Well, there's various versions of oral cancer. The most common I think people hear about are cancers of the tongue or the cheeks themselves, the inside lining of the cheeks, that is. Some people have issues with a little bit deeper into the mouth, so we worry about the voice box. And so each of these areas has their own particular needs and treatment plans.
What kinds of symptoms would we notice if we were developing an oral cancer? What would people be on the lookout for?
Well, honestly, sometimes they're symptomless. Sometimes we'll find a white spot or a red spot in the mouth when we're doing a routine exam. Sometimes a patient will notice something in their mouth that looks different. Their denture doesn't fit quite right like it used to. And sometimes that's what brings them in for a review.
Sometimes is there bleeding that takes place that is otherwise unexplained?
Sure, there can be those areas that will bleed, such as the cheek that we talked about. Are they sometimes sore? Absolutely. And again, sometimes that's because it's a rough area. Patients just happen to notice that this doesn't seem to go away. And sometimes that's the worst part, is that patients fear that this may be something bad, when in fact it may be just a broken tooth, a rough denture spot that needs to be looked at by the professional to take care of it. But oftentimes that's what brings folks in initially.
How about things like hoarseness? You were talking about it going further back in the throat.
Sure, a hoarseness that can't be explained. You know, when a patient has a lingering hoarseness for weeks and they perhaps have seen their primary, there's no particular diagnosis, or they think it's viral, but yet it persists for another month, that's not really normal. So that should be evaluated by a specialist.
And is there ever a problem with difficulty with chewing or swallowing, that kind of thing? Is that sometimes accompanying oral cancer?
Again, if it's long-term, it's been going on for weeks and or months, absolutely, that's something that should be looked at, just to make sure it's a benign process, or if it's not, that it be evaluated, perhaps biopsied, and then some evaluations and treatment options provided.
So who are the kinds of people that get oral cancer, or what kind of causes oral cancer?
Sure. The folks that we see that have probably the highest percentage of cancers in the mouth are going to be folks kind of with, unfortunately, the most obvious things you think of: smoking, excessive alcohol consumption, even like chewing tobacco. That's one that we highlight frequently because it's so obvious to us. We oftentimes will review that with the patient and talk to them about the hazards of it. Many times you may actually see almost like a, I don't want to say precancerous lesion, but something that you realize is not quite correct. So we will oftentimes take a picture of that area of the mouth, review that with the patient so that they're aware of it, and talk to them about, or counsel them about, tobacco cessation. There are options for everybody with regards to giving them substitutes to kind of get them off the habit of tobacco. But I'd say tobacco and alcohol certainly are the the most prevalent areas that need help in reducing those kinds of habits.
But there are other causes. In other words, there are some people maybe with family histories, or I read somewhere that up to 25% of all oral cancers do occur in people who don't even drink excessively or smoke.
Correct. And there are there are areas now which have gathered some more notoriety, such as the HPV virus, human papillomavirus, which is really, what does it really cause? It causes warts. But there are many versions of those. And so those in more recent years have become recognized as causing some forms of oral cancer.
So it's something you really want to be on the watch for.
Correct.
And especially if you have constant dental care, then clearly your dentist is on the watch for it.
Yes. I mean, you should ask your dentist if they routinely perform an oral cancer screen on you when you go in for your six-month recalls. That's one of the important facets that I think is lost on the general public, is that dentists do perform oral cancer screening, and that is just part of your normal routine six-month hygiene recall.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Patrick Smith, and we're talking about cancer and how it can affect our dentition. And particularly today, we've started talking about oral cancer. What exactly, or how exactly, is oral cancer treated?
I'd say there's a variety of means to treat it. Really, when you think about oral cancer, it's like any other cancer of the body, and oftentimes we'll respond in the same fashion. So we look at chemotherapy options, of course, surgery options. Sometimes when you have more advanced stages of cancer of the mouth, you want to treat it in an effort to shrink it before you actually perform surgery. So many oncology teams will try chemo first, followed by some radiation. They don't always go together. Sometimes it's just chemotherapy first, followed by evaluation and a determination on whether they need to perform surgery or not to remove that area of concern. Most oftentimes, I'll tell you, most surgeons do want to just remove the area of concern to be thorough about it.
Make sure that there's nothing left behind.
Correct.
So getting back to our initial premise, how does all of that affect our teeth or our mouths? In other words, any of these treatments, whether they be surgical, and now we're talking about in the mouth, but surgery obviously is localized to the mouth, but things like chemo or things like radiation, well, more chemo, affects the whole body. So how does that then come back and affect the teeth?
Well, the biggest problem area I think we see following treatment is going to be dry mouth. Especially with oral cancers, radiation treatment to the head and neck area almost universally always leads to dry mouth or xerostomia. In those situations, significant really counseling and preventative measures are important to make sure that we maintain the teeth. Very important that if someone has an early diagnosis, that they visit their dentist ahead of time to determine if they have any particular areas of concern, meaning do they have potential for abscess development? Do they have decay in their teeth? Whenever you have a dry mouth condition develop, any...
Can you define that a bit more? When you say dry mouth, what exactly do you mean?
Dry mouth really is any condition in which the patient notes that they are less moist than they used to be.
So do they feel thirsty all the time?
May not be a thirsty issue. That may be a side effect that you think you're thirsty. You're just not producing saliva like you once did. So why is that bad? Well, any plaque or calculus that exists on the teeth will only accelerate potential decay. And so it's something we see time and time again where patients come in and have had radiation in particular, and now they have significant decay patterns, because that really can cause a lot of problems post-treatment for the patients.
So is it the dry mouth environment that's caused by the treatment that then speeds up some of the decay processes and things that you're talking about?
Primarily, it's the radiation treatment. Radiation really dries out the salivary glands, and that's a long-term process, not something that you're going to recover from quickly. In fact, some patients never recover, so it's important that we treat those issues early.
So what happens if you don't have a dentist? What would you do? What do you recommend?
Really, I think the best approach in those situations is to ask your oncology team for a referral. Oftentimes they do work with someone, perhaps in-house, so to speak, at the hospital in which you're being treated. Here at Upstate, of course, we have our dental service, and so we work closely with our oncology associates for those folks who need help.
So there are ongoing treatments to prevent the effects of dry mouth and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Most of that really is at-home care.
Right.
We can't stress enough the importance of at-home care for the patients to make sure that they're providing themselves with a clean environment in their mouth. And that really is their best asset. Fluoride treatments, obviously routine brushing, routine checkups. And sometimes we'll accelerate those. Instead of 6 months, we'll do four-month checkups just to provide the best environment for the mouth.
So it sounds to me, I don't want to run out of time, the little bit of time we have left, that whether you have oral cancer or kidney cancer or some other kind of cancer in the body, you may be getting radiation, you may be getting chemotherapy, and you may be getting surgery. Do those other cancers or the treatments for those other cancers impact similarly on the mouth?
They can to some degree. The chemotherapy that people may receive also can cause dry mouth. Some of the medications will also facilitate dry mouth. So it's always important to go for a routine checkup. We can't stress that enough.
So it's really important to speak to your dentist or your oncology team and find a dentist and make sure that you're really caring for your
Absolutely.
Mouth throughout that
yeah.
whole thing. Well, thanks so much. My guest has been Dr. Patrick Smith. He's an assistant professor of surgery and the residency program director of the Dental Service and Clinic at Upstate Medical University. Next, what is adrenal insufficiency and how can it be helped? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Hormones play a critical role in our bodily functions, and there are many serious consequences when we lack the right balance of them. Well, joining me with what you should know about one such hormonal insufficiency is Dr. Roberto Izquierdo. He's professor of medicine and pediatrics and the division chief of pediatric endocrine and diabetes for Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Izquierdo.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Very nice to have you. So you're here to tell us about the adrenal glands and what happens when they don't produce enough of certain hormones, and mm-hmm. often called adrenal insufficiency, mm-hmm. right? Tell
yes.
us about that.
Well, the adrenal glands are two small glands which sit on top of the kidneys, and they make certain very important hormones. The outer layer makes two specific hormones, plus others, but the main ones are cortisol, which is a steroid, which helps with many bodily functions or metabolism to function normally. It also helps maintain the blood pressure and body functioning normally during times of illness. The second major hormone is called aldosterone, and that's a hormone that regulates salt and water in our bloodstream and in our body. And the irregularities of that hormone can lead to high blood pressure or low blood pressure. So it's also a very important hormone.
So basically, the adrenal glands produce two very important hormones mm-hmm. to regulate all of our bodily functions.
That's right. And then it also produces certain other hormones that are weak androgens, and they're produced both in women and men. And those hormones are important in the development of pubic hair and axillary hair.
Secondary sex characteristics.
Secondary sex characteristics.
So these hormones are crucial to our overall functioning.
That's right. Yeah.
And this is when you have primary, when the adrenal glands themselves are not functioning. Mm-hmm. Are there other types of insufficiency, adrenal insufficiency?
There's other types. There's secondary adrenal insufficiency.
What does that mean?
The adrenals are sort of under the guidance or control of the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland is a small size gland, the size of a pea, that extends from the base of the brain. And that it produces six different hormones. And the pituitary sometimes is called the master gland. And one of the hormones is called ACTH. And ACTH flows through the blood and signals to the adrenal glands how much cortisol to produce.
So in other words, that's the master gland. The pituitary is the master that tells the adrenals whether they should make their hormones or not. So you can have it either by the adrenal glands not functioning or the pituitary having a problem and telling the adrenal glands not to function.
That's right.
Or not telling it to function.
That's right.
One or the other. So give us a couple of other examples. I had come up with looking over some things that there are also issues about the immune system that are affected if you don't produce enough cortisol, for example.
Well, without cortisol, you could you develop a prolonged illness, which leads to fatigue and weight loss.
All kinds of issues.
And that could lead to an impaired immune system.
So what happens, really? How do you know? I mean, what are the symptoms, most common symptoms, if you have this insufficiency going on? How would someone have any clue that they might have adrenal insufficiency?
Yeah, for both primary and secondary adrenal insufficiency, you develop fatigue. In particular, for primary adrenal insufficiency, you also develop electrolyte imbalance, which means that your salt concentration in the body drops.
You might have low blood pressure as a result?
You may develop low blood pressure. You may become dehydrated. Many of these patients have also weight loss, and they crave salt. This is for the primary. Some of them, their skin becomes darkened and they develop a very nice tan.
Oh, so they get hyperpigmented on their skin.
Yeah.
So are those clues? In other words, if you were having any of these symptoms or these clues, because it seems to me something like fatigue can be caused by thousands of different things.
Yes.
A bad night's sleep, for example.
Yes.
So how would someone be able to tune in to the fact that there's something more going on? Yeah.
Well, I think if you do have chronic fatigue, that's otherwise the cause
unexplained.
You should consider this diagnosis, especially if it's associated with weight loss.
Oh, so those two things together. Yeah. And many times I've actually run across this on the internet. They talk about the cause of fatigue being something called adrenal fatigue.
Yeah.
Is there any?
Now, there's no
truth to that.
There's no scientific evidence that adrenal fatigue
exists.
So it's a notion that's espoused by some that chronic stress, physical or emotional, can lead to some sort of debilitation of the adrenal gland where they don't produce enough hormone. As compared to adrenal insufficiency, in adrenal insufficiency, you could actually measure the cortisol levels to be low.
So what you're saying is that sometimes fatigue can be blamed because in many cases, if you do have a problem with the adrenal glands, it does cause fatigue.
That's right.
So sometimes when people experience fatigue, they may think that it's because of their adrenals, but there's no scientific underpinning or proof of
that's
that.
That's right.
Okay, so that's kind of a myth.
Right, it's a myth.
And
the treatment for adrenal fatigue may be bad for you because you may be given steroids in form of pills, which then suppresses your own production of steroids.
So it's actually
right, maybe detrimental
treatment.
Yes.
Interesting. So who are the kinds of people who get this?
Well,
what ages, for example?
Actually, adrenal insufficiency can develop at any age.
At any age.
The more common one is secondary, so it's damage to the pituitary gland either through surgery or tumor. In some situations, when you administer steroids for other reasons, corticosteroids, like to treat rheumatoid arthritis or asthma, you could suppress your own endogenous production of cortisol. So and when you stop those steroids for those diseases, then you have a period of adrenal insufficiency until your own body.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, so, in other words, in trying to treat, some other disease entities, some other problems like, as you said, rheumatoid arthritis, you might be giving a steroid externally or by mouth or what have you, and that suppresses your own body's ability to produce, and then you end up with adrenal insufficiency.
That's right.
But that's not that's not permanent.
No, that's not transitory. Permanent. That's transient.
We were talking about all the different symptoms that come of it. The fact is that fatigue and weight loss are two of the most prominent ones, unexplained for any other reasons. And it can really wreak havoc with your body. Is it ever potentially lethal? I mean, it can ever cause death?
It can cause death. If you have adrenal insufficiency and you don't take your medicines or it goes unrecognized and you get an infection or some sort of involving some sort of trauma, this could lead to a severe deficiency of the hormone because normally we produce more cortisol during physical stress. And as such, you could develop an adrenal crisis, which is in which your blood pressure drops and you go into shock. And you also develop electrolyte abnormalities with very low sodium and high potassium. And it's a medical emergency.
So it is a medical. It can be very serious.
Yeah, people can die from it.
So what do you recommend then if people suspect they have any of these symptoms that are otherwise unexplained? They should probably seek medical advice.
Seek medical advice. See their medical provider. And the medical provider should do some testing, which includes electrolytes to check the sodium and potassium, which can be off in this condition, and also checking a cortisol level early in the morning. If the cortisol level early in the morning is very low, then it's consistent with the diagnosis of adrenal insufficiency. However, if the cortisol level is in the normal range, you could still have it, and then what we do is it's called a cortisone stimulation test, in which we draw a blood test. Measuring cortisol and aldosterone, then give a cortisone, which is synthetic ACTH, to stimulate the adrenal gland, and then we check the cortisol levels 30 minutes and 60 minutes afterwards to see if there's a response.
So that test basically first assesses in your blood whether you reduced cortisol and aldosterone, which are the two hormones that you need, that the adrenals produce.
Yes.
And then you give some treatment, which is the ACTH, and you see if it boosts it.
That's right.
Which will give you an indication that there really is some imbalance there. That's interesting. So we were saying earlier that it can happen to anyone and for various reasons throughout life. Are there genetic predispositions to this?
There's also genetic predispositions. There's a form that's detected at birth in which it's part of the newborn screen called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, where a child inherits two abnormal genes from an abnormal gene from each parent.
Would the parents already know they had this problem, or is it the kind of thing where it's recessive and they may not have known it?
The condition is recessive, so the parents have no symptoms, but the symptoms develop in
when they join together and the new baby has it.
Yeah.
So that's a genetic.
Yeah.
That's a genetic piece of it. Are there other causes for it?
Yeah. Other causes include adrenal hemorrhage, in which there's sort of a hemorrhage within the adrenal gland, which destroys it. And that sometimes can be seen in people that are taking anticoagulants, such as warfarin.
So if they're taking things that are blood thinners for other reasons, it could affect the adrenals.
That's right. And then the other possibility is inflammation. So patients around the world, patients who develop tuberculosis can develop adrenal insufficiency. And
is that because the infection destroys the adrenal glands in the process?
Yeah, the organism harbors in there. And patients who have HIV can develop also adrenal insufficiency due to some viral illness.
How about autoimmune diseases?
Yeah, autoimmune is the most common form that we see here in this country. And it's the immune cells, something triggers the immune cells to attack the adrenal gland cortex, and that destruction then leads to adrenal insufficiency.
So the immune system really is a key to
an
awful lot of our survival.
Yeah, and this brings another point that if you have adrenal insufficiency, just like type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease, we also need to check for other autoimmune diseases every so often because they may cluster together. So we got to check for pernicious anemia, which is due to vitamin B12 deficiency, check for diabetes, check for thyroid disease. So all these other conditions are at higher risk. A person with adrenals at a higher risk of developing.
So in other words, that's very interesting also. What you're suggesting is that there really is a tendency or predisposition that someone potentially inherits toward autoimmune diseases.
That's right.
And any of these diseases can occur, and they seem to cluster. So someone might have more than one.
More than one. So.
Very, very interesting. So how do you treat it?
Well, adrenal insufficiency, initially, if the patient presents in crisis like we talked about, then we give the hydrocortisone, which is cortisol, and we give it through the vein at very large doses. And we also give fluids in the form of normal saline, which is salt water, and also glucose, because these patients have a predisposition to low blood sugar. So after that initial acute phase, then the patients can take tablets, hydrocortisone tablets, which is cortisol, and usually that's, you have to take those pills twice a day. And then you also take another pill called fludrocortisone, which is similar to aldosterone, and that helps maintain your blood pressure and your salt levels in your body.
So you're basically supplementing these,
yes,
these hormones that the body is no longer producing adequately.
That's right.
But you mentioned the crisis. So is it the kind of thing where if it can develop gradually, people might not be aware of what's happening and end up finding themselves in some kind of a crisis?
Yes.
And then what recommendations, I mean, are there things people should have on hand if they suspect this could be happening?
Yeah, so if you do have adrenal insufficiency, then you know that you have the diagnosis. So in those patients, we instruct them on sick day rules, which means that they need to increase their hydrocortisone dose.
If they have an infection,
if they have an infection,
a cold
or a fever. So you just double, triple. If they go to surgery, we tell them to call us so we could get further instructions on higher doses of the hydrocortisone. In addition, it's a good idea to wear a med alert bracelet or necklace that identifies them in case they're ever in a car accident, they're unconscious or something like that. And we also tell them to have a hand injectable corticosteroid called salumedrol. That's one form. And just in case they have a vomiting illness or if they feel very sick, to give themselves an injection. We teach them how to do that. And that could at least get them through for the next several hours until they seek medical help.
So in other words, if they had a problem where they couldn't keep the pills down, is that the idea?
Yes.
In their medicine, they couldn't be taking their medicine on a regular basis due to some kind of nausea or vomiting,
right,
then they needed to have some kind of a syringe to be able to, or some way of giving themselves the medicine on
That's
a regular basis.
Yeah.
Is this for life then, basically?
This is for life. And also, not just vomiting. I had one provider that told me that a child developed adrenal glasses with a severe diarrheal illness because the pills were just going through and not being absorbed. So you got to keep that in mind, too.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, obviously, hormonal problems affect our bodies in such profound ways.
Yeah.
And this is something that isn't very well known and obviously can be mistaken for other things.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, when you have something like chronic fatigue, as we said, there could be thousands of potential reasons for it. So I think your key point here is that people should always check out with their physician the potential that this could be a potential part of their medical picture. Thank you so very much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Roberto Izquierdo, Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics and the Division Chief of Pediatric Endocrine and Diabetes for Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Woo! Done with that Megilla, or important and fun. Well, folks, I recently turned the new 40, shall we say, and for a few years, I've been aware that the cemetery behind my house might have something to do with me. That the names on the tombstones are not just curiously spelled abstract collections of letters from different cultures, but represent the sounds people made to talk with these people once alive. Like me, luckily still alive. And as an aside, when I typed alive, it came out a love. And yes, thank you to my unconscious, still alive and a love. So, strolling along through our cemetery, I committed to spending my remaining who knows how many more days on projects that feel important and fun. Now, I just finished a project I've been working on with some colleagues, developing a test to measure a new, more effective way to work in groups. And we've been working on it for about 400 million years. All right, really 10. But yeah, 10 years. Good thing I felt it was very important from when we began. How can it be that long, you might ask? And I'd have to say, gee, I don't know. Partly we had no idea how complicated it would be. Sort of like having a baby. One starts off with, shall we say, some excitement. Then things get complicated, like one's whole life changes in completely unanticipatable ways. And then the kids are grown and gone, and you're the new 40, right? So for the last several years, I've been thinking, I can't wait to get this thing done. It'll be such a weight off. I've been eating at my desk practically, and sometimes really drooling and dropping crumbs on my keyboard, working harder, harder, faster, desiring to push send on the here it is done email. And then there I was, project attached, my mind shouting, send it now. And I did. The big surprise? I felt almost exactly the same way before I sent it as after. A little relieved, but not much different. A bit of a weight off, but not much different. Moral of the story? Pick our projects carefully. Focus on our important outcome and smell the roses. Enjoy the soccer games, the baseball games, the lacrosse games, the dance lessons. Chuckle the chuckle. Dance the merry dance along the way. That's a better way to work in groups and families. I'm Rich, alive and alive, O'Neill. Have fun. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, how can seasonal weather changes wreak havoc with our breathing? And be sure to stay with us for our visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for July 22nd. This week's tip is retreat from the heat. Between 1979 and 2003, more Americans died from excess heat exposure than from hurricanes, lightning, tornadoes, floods, and earthquakes combined. Extreme temperatures can cause many serious health problems, like heat stroke, heat exhaustion, heat cramps, sunburn, and heat rashes. During the height of summer, it is important to check that loved ones and pets have the water and cool shelter they need to stay safe. This week, take precautions for yourself and your family to avoid heat-related illnesses. Drink more fluids, but avoid alcoholic and sugary drinks. Wear lightweight and light-colored and loosely fitting clothing, and limit outdoor activity to the morning or evening. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Well, this time of year, as the weather gets warmer, there is often an increase in the number of calls to 911 with people having difficulty breathing. In this edition of What's Your Emergency, Dr. Derek Cooney, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University, is here to help us explore why this occurs and what can be done to prevent trouble. Welcome, Dr. Cooney. Thanks for coming in today.
It's always good to be here.
So why is this season, general time, why is it a season for more difficulties in breathing?
Well, you know, seasonal changes in general, and it doesn't always have to be the spring to summer period, can change the allergens in the air, and a lot of individuals in our community are sensitive to that. Now, we all know that people with asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, can be extra sensitive to mild infections and allergens. But what some people forget is that folks that don't normally have problems with asthma or reactive airway disease could have that seasonally. And we want them to remember that that's an important cause of shortness of breath. And there may be some very easy things they could do to prevent having this become a real emergency.
You know, it's very interesting because I've noticed in recent years, last year or two, that I've developed seasonal allergies of sorts. It hasn't actually progressed to the point of having difficulty breathing, but clearly it seems like the whole allergic environment here in upstate New York has changed, or maybe I've changed, but I've heard that from other people, that it's been a much more allergic-inducing environment. Are you noticing that as well?
I haven't noticed that specifically, but the trends are tracked, and you can look for changes in pollen and different mold spores, et cetera. So there is data out there on that. But each individual is affected differently. So sometimes it doesn't affect the whole population in a specific way. But individuals need to be aware that seasonality to their allergies could result in shortness of breath if they've had problems in the past especially.
Now, you've also, at other times when you've been here, talked to me about the fact that shortness of breath, which is difficulty breathing, could also be the sign of something else, not just asthma or a chronic condition like COPD. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a very good point. And shortness of breath can be related to cardiac problems. Even heart attack can cause shortness of breath. It could be related to a blood clot in the lung. Some people are at risk for that, depending on if they've been in a long car ride on an airplane for a long time, or they have certain genetic predisposers, or they've had a recent surgery, et cetera, so they have blood clots can form in their leg, and they go to their lung, and that actually causes shortness of breath. That's the primary presenting feature of that condition. So you may be suffering from some shortness of breath. Some people might say, well, we probably just got a cold, maybe even pneumonia, because there's a little discomfort in my chest. But really, it's a much more serious or threatening condition.
So the truth is, we should pay attention to shortness of breath.
Absolutely, and they don't have, it's their new slogan, but it's interesting because the American Lung Association used to say, if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. But it can be, and the reason they were saying that to people is to remind you how important it is to have good respiratory function. And if things are wrong, it may be very, very serious.
So how do you know when it's serious enough to call 911 or call an ambulance or seek medical care?
Well, when you have mild cough or respiratory difficulty, most people realize that they've got the start of an infection, which may be serious, but it hasn't gotten that point yet. Those folks can probably go to their primary care doctor or the urgent care and get checked out, and usually don't require any significant evaluation like a chest X-ray or anything beyond that. However, if you or a loved one is experiencing significant breathing difficulty to the point where they're breathing rapidly or shallower, or they're getting confused, or even worse yet, if their lips or parts of their body were to become gray or pale or blue, which we would call cyanosis, that's a sign of a very serious condition. And if it's primary respiratory, it usually means that folks have to get specific therapy for their lungs. They've run out of albuterol, their inhalers or their nebulizers aren't working, and they need to call 911 right away.
Is there also something about the suddenness of onset, potentially, that would give you a clue as to that this is an emergency? In other words, if all of a sudden you can't breathe.
Right. So if all of a sudden someone has respiratory distress, even if it's not so severe as to cause those things we just talked about, if it's a sudden shortness of breath, that's concerning. that can be a lot of different things. Could be a cardiac dysrhythmia, could be that blood clot in the lungs, could be a cardiac clot, which we, you know, basically a myocardial infarction. So abrupt shortness of breath, that's a real concerning condition.
And sometimes accompanied by things like fainting. Obviously, if you faint, you're going to think something is amiss. But even even something like severe nausea or vomiting.
Severe nausea, vomiting, lightheadedness, blurred vision, confusion. These things tell us that in addition to the shortness of breath, they're probably not getting enough oxygen for their usual normal organs to normal function of their organs, whether it be their heart or their stomach or their brain.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here, and I'm here with Dr. Derek Cooney, and we're talking about breathing emergencies. So let's get to this emergency concept here. So what should you do? I mean, it seems quite obvious, but what should you do if any of these symptoms or signs occur?
So people who have COPD or asthma usually know they need to get their inhaler out, they need to use their nebulizer, and if that functions and lessens the emergency, then sometimes that will get them to the point where they could go somewhere and see a physician, not necessarily the emergency department, but they've taken...
Outpatient basis
or urgent care. But if they've already using their inhaler or they're using their nebulizer and they're not getting better, that's an emergency. They need to call 911. They need to get the ambulance there.
How about for some of these other potentially life-threatening situations that we've discussed? Like all of a sudden you get shortness of breath and you might have an embolus to your... a pulmonary embolus, for example.
Right. Again, that's a reason to call 911 right away. Let the paramedic and the EMT get there and take a look, get them on the monitor. They can do a lot with their protocols. If they can identify a probable cause, they can start therapy on the way to the hospital.
That's a good question. Before they actually show up, though, what can you or should you do if you're having that difficulty as you wait for the ambulance?
Well, if you don't have a history of respiratory difficulties and you don't have medications to take for it, you really need to get someone to stay with you. You need to make sure that you're not exerting yourself. And while you wait, listen to the 911 operator give you instructions. In addition, it's helpful if there's someone else with you, collect up your medical information, get your medication list, because that gives clues to the pre-op providers as well as us in the emergency department what might be the cause.
Now, you mentioned when you're in the ambulance, what should you expect? I mean, you said the paramedics are trained, and if they suspect a probable cause, they'll begin treatment.
Right.
Has that changed? Have their abilities to treat improved in the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20
absolutely.
Years?
Oh, absolutely. We continue to increase their capabilities nationwide, but also locally. For example, if you have asthma, you could potentially get oxygen, but you could also get nebulized albuterol to try to open your lungs, and now steroids as well, because steroids are shown to help in severe asthma and COPD. We also have CPAP, which is a mask that they can be put on. Some people sleep with it for sleep apnea, but it actually helps in this condition too. It helps ventilate, get more oxygen in, more CO2 out, and can help get someone through that emergency part of their respiratory stress. In fact, there's been studies shown that when we use these modalities before they show up to the emergency department, they have a shorter stay, and many times they don't get the more serious interventions like being intubated and put
which
on a
means,
ventilator.
Which means
with
a
breathing
tube.
Tube, right. And even the paramedics in the field, they can do that as well if it's necessary. But we're trying to prevent that. We're trying to prevent big interventions that then cause people to go to the intensive care unit, and then they can sometimes get a lot of sequelae or complications just relative to being on the ventilator.
It strikes me that that suggests even more, underscores how important it is to call professionals, like to call an ambulance or 911 when you have something of this nature, because they are actually beginning treatment from the moment they arrive.
Absolutely.
As opposed to you're trying to drive or have someone drive you to the hospital.
Absolutely. And sometimes that shortness of breath is a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, and they get it on EKG, and they can see, they call ahead, and you go fast to the cath lab, which is where we want you to go.
So the concept here is obviously you're being cared for on the way. When you get to, what can you expect when you get to an emergency room? Obviously, it's going to be based on what the cause is.
Right.
But what generally does happen?
Well, if it's something simple, you know, it may be just simple as doing the kind of therapy that we've already talked about, maybe getting a chest x-ray to make sure there's not an pneumonia complicating the situation or congestive heart failure fluid in the lungs, make sure there's not a pneumothorax, which could be
collapsed
lung, right? Because that sometimes looks like other things. Then if it's serious but difficult to to determine. In the emergency department, we can get labs, we can get nasal swabs for children if they have a severe respiratory distress, and there might be a specific infectious cause. But even more importantly, sometimes we even have to get a CAT scan just to get to the bottom of what's causing the respiratory distress.
So you do whatever testing is necessary, right, and to kind of piece together the cause. But as you said, if they suspect a heart attack and that shows up on an EKG, they can actually take you right away to a catheterization lab and perhaps put a stent in?
Correct. That's the goal. So if it's not a primary pulmonary condition, we're gonna have to look deeper, and in the emergency department, we have the tools to do that. And fortunately, here at University Hospital, we have a wide variety of subspecialty services. We have cardiothoracic surgery, we have pulmonology, we have intensive care physicians, and obviously we have cardiologists who can do interventions in the cath lab. So we're very lucky here.
It must be very scary to not be able to breathe. So is there something in the training of the paramedics and or the emergency room doctors that address that issue for the patient?
It's just a humanistic approach. You just have to, you know, have to explain what's going on. You have to tell them we're there to help, because obviously we are there to help. And we have to tell them what's going on. We have to explain the interventions, because, you know, if you can't breathe and someone says, I'm going to put this over your face, you know, the CPAP mask or the BiPAP in the emergency department, you know, you have to explain what that is. We even sometimes give sedatives to make people tolerate the CPAP or other interventions. And again, it's all about talking to people and making them understand that we're there to help and what we can do for them.
In the little bit of time we have left, are there ways to prevent these breathing emergencies in some cases?
So if you have a chronic lung condition, you need to keep your prescriptions up to date. If you have a seasonal problem, you don't need your albuterol inhaler or your nebulizer off season, remember to make sure that it's always up to date anyway, because if you travel or the allergens change, you could get an exacerbation when you don't expect it. So you need to make sure that your medications are up to date. You need to keep those primary care appointments. And if you're on a chronic daily medication, you can't run out of that. You need to make sure you keep your prescription up to date and continue to take your medicine.
Thanks so much. My guest has been Dr. Derek Cooney, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's Literary Journal, with this week's offering from the Healing Muse. I've brought us two poems to think about today. They talk about illness from the point of view of a caregiver and a person who is actually ill. The Country of Illness is by Meryl Natchez. She dropped out of Radcliffe and decided after a year at school, at an Ivy League school, that she would rather homeschool herself. And she's been busily writing poetry ever since. I love this poem, The Country of Illness. Your body no longer belongs to you, but to technicians whose work is the body. Your time is taken up in the exhausting task of translating the confusing currency, adapting to customs that seem pure insult where you come from. Travel here is hard, light and clatter just when you want dim sleep. Visitors with their annoying questions, as if you knew anything useful. It takes all your time just to decipher the map, the border instructions, while you slowly work to put together the price of the ticket back to the land of the well, where we take our bodies blessedly for granted. You swear if your frail boat ever arrives at that shore again, you'll treasure every moment without pain, appreciate the feet that carry you everywhere, the arms that lift and hold and lift at your command. But it's not possible. The healthy breathe health like fish breathe water. We move at will, cursing when the car won't start or the coffee spills, and all the while the dark blood pulses and health glints, thoughtless as moonlight on black water. Meryl Natchez was talking about how it is we look at health after we have been ill. In the next poem by Nina Bennett, she talks about what it's like when you get that phone call. A Phone Call After Midnight by Nina Bennett. Never brings good news. My father's bedside dialysis line has clotted again, third night in a row, after his family stumbled home from the hospital to shed tears hidden not only from him, but from each other. The doctor says my father, intubated and less responsive each day, communicates in the only language he can access, declares his wishes to those who will listen. I drink coffee until daybreak, drive to my childhood home. Mom sits on the patio, stares at the overgrown clematis Dad planted, shakes her head when I start to speak. She puts on gardening gloves, picks up the pruner, clips until violet flowers spring free, released from the confines of tangled vine. Chooses a blossom the shade of midnight for Dad, a jolt of color against the white sheets and metal of the ICU. Dad died that evening, his final exhale so gentle it didn't ruffle the faded flower resting on his chest.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.